Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up tomorrow, when people not so close to death live in a hospice. Monday, who really benefits from sports and concert ticket resales? Tuesday, Juan Williams. So a lot to listen for every day here on The Brian Lehrer Show. And welcome to the Rupert Murdoch News International scandal, day 17. Or is it day 60? Or day 323? Day infinity? The point is, the more we learn about how widespread the practice of phone hacking and the subsequent cover-up was, the more we learn about just how far back this story goes and how intertwined the media, law enforcement, and political worlds in England and here in the U.S. really are. And it continues to grow, rocking the establishment to its very news core. But there, essentially, from day one, has been Guardian reporter Nick Davis. He was the one who first alerted his paper that the scandal over phone hacking way back in 2009 was more than just one bad apple within News of the World. And he was the one who helped reveal more recently that the paper had hacked into the voicemail of a missing girl, interfering with an ongoing police investigation. Nick Davis joins us now from the Guardian offices in London. We'll talk about the timeline of this story, but also some big picture about the media environment as it stands today, as we're trying to do in each of these conversations. As it happens, his latest book was titled Flat Earth News: An Award-Winning Reporter Exposes Falsehood, Distortion, and Propaganda in the Global Media. Nick Davis, welcome to WNYC, and I trust that you've gotten pretty much zero sleep over the last 3 weeks.
You're right. I'm running on nervous energy and caffeine.
And
but I'm with you. I'm awake.
Okay, that's good. Nervous energy, caffeine, and a healthy dose of I told you so. But let's start with that big picture analysis. With you having an inside view of the media landscape around this story, can you place News of the World in context for us for here in the U.S.? When you first started investigating, did you already sense that this was a story about News Corp and Murdoch in general, or was it a story about one particular tabloid?
In fact, it was always a much bigger story than that, because from the outset you could see this is a story about the power elite. So in the UK context, you're looking at the most powerful news organisation in the country, the Murdoch organisation. You're also looking at the failure of the most powerful police force in the country, the Metropolitan Police at Scotland Yard. You're also looking at the most powerful political party, the Conservatives, who were about to become the government and who had hired this former editor of the News of the World to be the Prime Minister's right-hand man. And for good measure, you were always looking at also our press regulatory body, the Press Complaints Commission. And the extraordinary thing about this story, this funny little story about journalists behaving badly, is the way that it exposed the abuse of power by all those highly powerful organizations. So from the outset, you could always see the shape of the thing was huge.
And this coziness between the media and the government, you know, it seems to me that it's going the opposite direction than it usually goes. I think when we think of media and government being too cozy, we think of the media, therefore, not doing its job. If they're too close to the government, they're not going to hold the government accountable in the way that the news organizations are supposed to do. In this case, I think we have the government failing to hold the news organization accountable for its possible criminal activity with Scotland Yard taking a dive for Rupert Murdoch. Is that true?
I think that is true. You're right, because the bigger picture here is that the balance of power has got out of whack in this country and others where Murdoch operates, because the government, who are supposed to be running the political machine, and the police, who are supposed to be enforcing law and order, both feel that they do not have as much power as this news organization, which controls four of our national newspapers and a powerful news channel. And for that reason, government and police alike start to step back. And instead of doing what they should be doing, they start anticipating what the Murdoch organization would want them to do and falling in step with them. So when you look at government, for example, that funny old idea that some of us have had about one man, one vote turns out to count very little. You
How
have
quaint.
One Australian man who's adopted American nationality who is bullying the British government, and as he has bullied the Australian government, and for all we know, maybe doing a little bit of bullying around at the back of the White House right now.
Well, in fact, I read this morning that News Corp in this country has retained the firm of the former Attorney General of the United States under George W. Bush, Michael Mukasey, to defend its holdings here in the U.S. That must mean they're anticipating some kind of trouble on this side of the Atlantic. But it also, again, shows the connectedness. If he can hire most recent past U.S. Attorney General and the most recent past U.S. Attorney in New York, Mary Jo White, also hired by the Murdoch Company, then that shows, again, the closeness with the government in this country, or at least those officials who were in the Bush administration and now back in private practice. But I want to ask your take on maybe an even bigger question, which is what the Murdoch Company is really about and is really after. Maybe you read Jay Rosen, professor here in New York at NYU, who wrote a column in your paper, The Guardian, this week, in which he writes, News Corp is not a news company at all, but a global media empire that employs its newspapers and in the U.S. Fox News as a lobbying arm. What makes them different is not that they have a more conservative take on the world, but rather news is not their first business. Wielding influence is. How much do you agree with that?
There is certainly a truth in there. I mean, the reality is that day by day, for most of the time, these newspapers are reporting something they would call news. Mm-hmm. Actually, the big weakness of that is that it's completely commercially directed, and it may be extremely unreliable. All they're trying to do is sell papers. But once you have an organization which sells that many newspapers to that many people, which controls the flow of that much television news to that many viewers, you have inherently got power in a democratic society. And there is no doubt at all that the owner of that power, Rupert Murdoch and his family, have abused that power in Australia and in the United Kingdom, and who knows, perhaps in the United States. There are politicians, certainly in Australia and the United Kingdom, who will tell you that they have had that organization coming in and interfering in their policy making. And there are politicians in both countries who would say that they feel their governments were ousted by the hostility of those organizations. Kevin Rudd's last government in Australia, I think Gordon Brown's government in the UK, they may have had all kinds of objective political problems. Who knows, perhaps they would have lost power anyway. But in both those cases, certainly, the Murdoch organization turned on them and decided to get them out of power. And you remember in the background, there's this funny little thing we call the electorate, who like to think that it's there who are making these decisions.
Right. And yet, I wonder how far we want to take this argument, because there are news organizations of all ideological stripes. Certainly, The Guardian is a liberal paper. And you would want, and the publishers of your paper, I think, would want to wield influence in the political sector and have influence on policy by exposing truth and reporting truth from your perspective. So how is that different?
Okay. The main way in which newspapers like to think they've got influence is through their leader comment. So they endorse a particular party at an election, and that's absolutely fine and legitimate.
Or they report details of policy and details of reality that influence public opinion.
Okay, so I was just about to come on to it. Then there's a second thing, which is that in the selection of the stories which you choose to tell the truth about, then I think it's also legitimate to do that.
Yes.
But then there's a different thing, which is brazen distortion, a news agenda which is set by hostility. I'll give you a concrete example. When Gordon Brown was Prime Minister, after the Murdoch organization decided to hunt him down and get him out of power, he wrote a letter to the mother of a soldier, a British soldier who'd been killed in Afghanistan, and he wrote it by hand. Now, on the face of it, you might think that's an extraordinarily kind gesture of a man who is a prime minister and a busy, busy guy to actually sit down and write it by hand, not have an official do it. The Sun got hold of that letter and discovered that it had one or two spelling mistakes in it. Bear in mind, Gordon Brown is a man who lost an eye years ago and has only one. And instead of saying, there's a decent man taking time out to express how he feels, they used the spelling mistakes to launch a vitriolic campaign against him, implying that he was a sloppy guy who didn't care. And that's unfair. That's vitriol. And it's politically inspired vitriol from an organization that had made a decision that they wanted somebody else to be prime minister.
Jim Sleeth,
you see the distinction between that and legitimate exposure of truth?
I see.
Is the point I'm trying to get at.
I see the distinction that you're making.
Okay.
Jim Sleeper in Dissent magazine wrote, by playing on our all-too-human temptation to displace our hopes and fears onto celebrities and scapegoats, Murdoch's journalism accelerates self-fulfilling prophecies of civic decay in every body politic it touches. It reduces citizens to consumers and then blames them for their discontents. Now, that's another kind of critique. That's the critique of the tabloid mentality in general, which, you know, reduces us to consumers rather than citizens, places our hopes and fears onto celebrities and scapegoats, and yet it reinforces the worldview that the Murdoch establishment would have of a corrupt establishment.
That's a really interesting and very complicated subject. I mean, if you look back over the last 30 or 40 years, particularly I think in Western Europe, you can see a tectonic shift in culture. So that whereas certainly in Europe, people who would once have identified themselves in social and political terms now do indeed identify themselves merely as consumers. So instead of saying, I am working class, I am a trade unionist, people just say, well, I want a holiday and this is what I want to buy. There's a huge cultural shift. I think you'd be hard put to say that that was actually caused by the tabloid press. They may have been a factor in creating it, and certainly they've reacted to and reinforced it. But its roots are very deep in all sorts of political and economic shifts. But there it is, it's happened. Yeah. And to the extent that the tabloids reflect it, I think that they do reinforce it. And it's terribly regrettable because you're separating large chunks of the population from the political and economic reality that has so much to do with their everyday lives. They cease to understand it. They cease to want to know about it because, as that guy rightly puts it, they've become mere consumers. Huge loss.
Yes. Deep thoughts flowing from,
you started it.
I did start it. And these are the conversations that I think we really need to have coming out of the hacking scandal, not just who broke what law or who broke what ethical standard. As we talked to Nick Davis from The Guardian, who originally broke the Murdoch paper hacking story, I want to take one phone call of pushback against something that you said from Louise in Manhattan. Louise, thank you for calling.
Hi. Let me turn off the radio. The idea that the Murdoch press influences opinion by, portraying a very subjective view of the news, they all do that. The New York Times is notorious. And when you realize how much is happening in every paper, I don't see how you can accuse one of especially doing that more than another.
Well, in a way, we're going back to the point that we made earlier, that I think there is a set of legitimate ways in which newspapers can express their moral and political values. So selecting particular stories to write about is one legitimate way. That's okay. But there is a different thing which has to be separated, which is that having chosen a story, you then distort it. Distortion generally means that you fail to present the total picture.
No, but the New York Times does that all the time. If you really understand an issue and read the way they portray it, you won't recognize it. They have their biases just as the others, and I don't think that you can pin this just on Murdoch. They do that. We think that, oh, yes, all the news that's fit to print, but it's not true. They're just portraying one side, and the photo editor is the biggest culprit. Because you don't even have to read that article. You walk by the newsstand, you see the photo, you know who's the good guy and who's the bad guy.
You can certainly express editorial views without nary a word. But, Nick, I know we're going around in circles on this, so just one more response to Louise.
Well, it's difficult for me to talk about the New York Times because I don't read it because I live in London. But I would invite you to ask yourself whether there's a difference in the approach to news between the New York Times and the New York Post. And even if you want to say that both newspapers fail in some respect, I would suggest you discover that they fail in a different way and at a different level.
Two more things, really quick. One is, I know you were also one of the main reporters for The Guardian on the WikiLeaks stories.
Oh, yeah.
And I see that 14 or 16 members of the group Anonymous were arrested in the United States on Tuesday. And this story has gotten hardly any press here because of Murdoch, I think. And, of course, their crime allegedly was hacking into MasterCard and Visa after those companies had cut off WikiLeaks accounts. Is there a relationship here? I can't help but wonder that now that hacking is such a dirty word because of Murdoch, the U.S. Justice Department may have felt at a little bit more liberty to go after those supporters of WikiLeaks.
I think you're engaging in conspiracy theories there. I would say that group of hackers have been a target of law enforcement agencies for some time. quite openly and overtly, and they didn't need the Murdoch story to make them feel that that was a legitimate
but
thing to go down.
But it happened on the very day that Murdoch was testifying.
You've got to resist these conspiracy theories. They'll lead you into very dark corners. Another way of answering the same question is I haven't got the faintest idea.
All right. So educate us Americans here for a second. Your last name is D-A-V-I-E-S, which I would pronounce Davies, like Ray Davies of the Kinks. But you say Davis. So you have to tell me, was I saying Ray Davies' name wrong all these years?
Yeah. He'll forgive you. But yeah, I think... Yes, is this really the most important thing you
it
want to ask
me? It is the last most important thing.
All right. I think that the Welsh people who produced these names in the first place pronounce that Davis, even if it's got an E in it. But we're not too worried about it.
Nick Davis from The Guardian, who first broke the News of the World hacking story. Thank you very much.
Okay, good luck.
Body and his mind, you will respect his name.